Welcome to this Uvula audio presentation of P.G. Woodhouse's Aunts Aren't Gentlemen. I'm your narrator, Jim Campanella. Aunts Aren't Gentlemen is a comic novel by P.G. Woodhouse, first published in the U.K. in October 1974 by publishers Berry & Jenkins, and in the U.S. under the title The Catnappers in 1975 by Simon & Schuster. This was the last novel to feature some of Woodhouse's best-known characters, Bertie Wooster and the ever-resourceful valet Jeeves. It was the last novel fully completed by Woodhouse before his death. This story has a great many of the echoes of all the other classic Bertie and Jeeves novels, as you will find as you listen. The story begins with Bertie finding pink spots on his thorax. On doctor's orders, Bertie retires to the village of Maiden Egsford in Somerset to rest. But poor Bertie's sleep of the just, as he calls it, will never see the light of day. He is first interrupted by Aunt Dahlia, who wants him to nobble a racehorse. This annoyance is followed by another of his old fiancées, Vanessa Cook, who wants him to act as a go-between for her and Orlo Porter. Of course, there's also Orlo Porter himself, who would tear Bertie limb from limb if he ever discovered that Bertie and Vanessa were once engaged. Throw in a dotty explorer, an unreliable poacher, an irascible father, and the stable cat, and the stage is set for one of Woodhouse's most sublime farces. And now, Aunts Aren't Gentlemen. 1.
My attention was drawn to the spots on my chest when I was in my bath singing, if I remember rightly, the Toreador song from the opera Carmen. They were pink in color, rather like the first faint flush of dawn, and I viewed them with concern. Not a fussy man, but I do object to being freckled like a pard, as I once heard Jeeves describe it. A pard, I take it, being something on the order of one of those dogs beginning with D. Jeeves, I said at the breakfast table, I've got spots on my chest.
Indeed, sir.
Pink.
Indeed, sir.
I don't like them.
A very understandable prejudice, sir. Might I inquire if they itch?
Sort of.
I would advocate not scratching them, sir.
I disagree with you. You have to take a firm line with spots. Remember what the poet said?
Sir?
The poet, Ogden Nash. The poem he wrote defending the practice of scratching. Who was Barbara Fritchie, Jeeves?
A lady of some prominence in the American war between the states, sir.
Well, here's what the poet Nash wrote. I'm greatly attached to Barbara Fritchie. I bet she scratched when she was itchy. But I shall not be content with scratching. I shall place myself in the hands of a competent doctor.
A very prudent decision, sir.
The trouble was that except for measles when I was just starting out, I've always been so fit I didn't know any doctors. Then I remembered my American pal, Timpton Plimsoll, with whom I had been dining last night to celebrate his betrothal to Veronica, only daughter of Colonel and Lady Hermina Wedge of Blandings Castle, Shropshire. He had mentioned a doctor who had once done him a bit of good. I went to the telephone to get his name and address. Tipton did not answer my ring immediately, and when he did it was to reproach me for waking him at daybreak. But after he got this off his chest, and I had turned the conversation to mine, he was most helpful. It was with the information I wanted I returned to Jeeves. I've just been talking to Mr. Plimsoll, Jeeves, and everything is straight now. He bids me lose no time in establishing contact with a medico of the name of E. Jimson Murgatroyd. He says if I want a sunny practitioner who will prod me in the ribs with his stethoscope and tell me an anecdote about two Irishmen named Pat and Mike and then another about two Scotsmen named Mac and Sandy, E. Jimson is not my man. But if what I'm after is someone to cure my spots, he is unquestionably, as he knows his spots from A to Z, and has been treating them since he was so high. It seems that Tipton had the same trouble not long ago, and Murgatroyd fixed him up in no time. So while I am getting out of these clothes into something more spectacular, will you give him a buzz and make an appointment? When I had doffed the sweater and flannels in which I had breakfasted, Jeeves informed me that E. Jimson could see me at 11. I thanked him and asked him to tell the garage to send the car around at 10:45.
Somewhat earlier than that, sir,
he said.
If I might make the suggestion, the traffic, would it not be better to take a cab?
No, and I'll tell you why. After I've seen the doctor, I thought I might drive down to Brighton and get a spot of sea air. I don't suppose the traffic will be any worse than usual, will it?
I fear so, sir. A protest march is taking place this morning.
What, again? They seem to have them every hour on the hour these days, don't they?
They are certainly not infrequent, sir.
Do you have any idea what they're protesting now?
I could not say, sir. Might be one thing or it might be another. Men are suspicious, prone to discontent. Subjects still loathe the present government.
The poet Nash?
No, sir. The poet Herrick.
Pretty bitter.
Yes, sir.
I wonder what they had done to him to stir him up like that. Probably fined him £5 for failing to abate a smoke chimney.
As to that, I have no information, sir.
Sitting in the old sports model, some minutes later, and driving to keep my tryst with E. Jimson Murgatroyd, I was feeling singularly light-hearted for a man with spots on his chest. It was a beautiful morning, and it wouldn't have taken much to make me sing tra-la as I billed along. Then I came abaft of the protest march, and found myself becalmed. I leaned back and sat observing the proceedings with a kindly eye. Whatever these bimbos were protesting about, it was obviously something they were taking to heart, rather. By the time I got into their midst, not a few of them had decided that animal cries were insufficient to meet the case, and were saying it with bottles and brickbats, and the police, who were present in considerable numbers, seemed not to be liking it much. Must be rotten being a policeman on these occasions. Anyone who's got a bottle can throw it at you, but if you throw it back, the yell of police brutality goes up and there are editorials in the paper the next day. But the mildest cop can stand on his so much, and it seemed to me, for I am pretty shrewd in these matters, that in about another shake of a duck's tail, hell's foundations would be starting to quiver. I hoped no one would scratch my paint. Leading the procession, I saw with surprise a girl that I knew. In fact, I had once asked her to marry me. Her name was Vanessa Cook, and I had met her at a cocktail party, and such was her radiant beauty that it was only a couple of minutes after I had brought her a martini and one of those little sausages on sticks that I was saying to myself, "Bertram, this is a good thing, push it along." And in due season I suggested a merger, but apparently I was not the type, and no business resulted. This naturally jarred the Worcester soul a good deal at the moment, but reviewing the dead past now, I could see that my guardian angel had been on the job all right, and had known what was good for me. I mean, radiant beauty is all very well, but it isn't everything. What sort of a married life would I have had with a little woman perpetually going on protest marches, and expecting me to be at her side throwing bottles at the constabulary? It made me shudder to think what I might have let myself in for if I had been a shade more fascinating. Taught me a lesson, that did. Viz., never to lose faith in your guardian angel, because these guardian angels are no fools. Vanessa Cook was accompanied by a beefy bloke without a hat, in whom I recognized another old acquaintance, O.J. Orlo Porter, to wit, who had been on the same staircase with me at Oxford. Except for borrowing an occasional cup of sugar from one another, and hallooing when we met on the stairs, we had never been really close, he being a prominent figure at the Union, where I was told he made fiery, far-to-the-left speeches, while I was more the sort that is content just to exist beautifully. Nor did we get together in our hours of recreation, for his idea of a good time was to go off with a pair of binoculars and watch birds, a thing that has never appealed to me. I can't see any percentage in it. If I meet a bird, I wave a friendly hand at it to let it know that I wish it well, but I don't want to crouch behind a bush observing its habits. So, as I say, Orlo Porter was in no sense a buddy of mine, but we had always got on all right, and I still saw him every now and then. Everybody at Oxford had predicted a pretty hot political future for him, but it hadn't got started yet. He was now in the employment of the London and Home Counties Insurance Company, and earned the Daily Bee by talking poor saps, I was one of them, into taking out policies for larger amounts than they would have preferred. Making fiery far-to-the-left speeches naturally fits a man for selling insurance, enabling him to find the mot juste and enlarging the vocabulary. I, for one, had been corn before his sickle, as the expression is. The bottle throwing had now reached the height of its fever, and I was becoming more than ever nervous about my paint, when all of a sudden there occurred an incident which took my mind off that subject. The door of the car opened, and what the papers called a well-nourished body, male, leaped in and took a seat beside me. gave me a bit of a start. I don't mind admitting the Worcesters not being accustomed to this sort of thing so soon after breakfast. I was about to ask what I was indebted for the honor of this visit when I saw that what I had drawn was all a porter, and I divined that after the front of the procession had passed from my view, he must have said or done something which London's police force could not overlook. Making instant flight was a must. His whole demeanor was that of the hart that pants for cooling streams when heated in the chase. Well, you don't get cooling streams in the middle of the metropolis, but there was something I could do to give his morale a shot in the arm. I directed his attention to the Drones Club scarf lying on the seat, at the same time handing him my hat. He put them on, and the rude disguise proved effective. Various razors came along, but they were looking for a man without a hat, and he was definitely hatted, so they passed us by. Of course I was bareheaded, but one look at me was enough to tell them that this polished boulevardier could not possibly be the dubious character they were after. And a few minutes later the crowd had melted.
"Drive on, Worcester. Get a move on, blast you,"
said Orlo. He spoke irritably, and I remembered that he had always been an irritable chap, as who would not have been, having to go through life with a name like Orlo and peddling in churns when he had hoped to electrify the House of Commons with his molten eloquence. I took no umbrage, accordingly, if umbrage is the thing that you take when people start ordering you about, making allowances for his state of mind. I drove on, and he said, "Phew," and removed a bead of persp from his brow. I hardly knew what to do for the best. He was still panting like a hart, and some fellows, when panting like harts, enjoy telling you all about it, while others prefer a tactful silence. I decided to take a chance. "Spot of trouble," I said.
"Yes."
"Off on the way during these protest marches, what happened?"
"I socked a cop."
I could see why he was a bit emotional. Socking cops is a thing that should be done sparingly, if at all. I resumed the quiz. "Any particular reason, or did it just seem like a good idea at the time?" He gnashed a tooth or two. He was a red-headed chap, and my experience of the red-headed is that you can always expect high blood pressure from them in times of stress. The first Queen Elizabeth had red hair, and look what she did to Mary Queen of Scots.
"He was arresting the woman I love."
I can understand how this might well have annoyed him. I have loved a fair number of women in my time, though it always seems to wear after a while, and I should probably have drained the bitter cup a bit if I had seen any of them pinched by the police. "What has she done?" I asked.
"She was heading the procession with me, shouting a good deal, as always happens on these occasions when the emotions of a generous girl are stirred. He told her to stop shouting. She said this was a free country and she was entitled to shout as much as she pleased. He said not if she was shouting the sort of thing she was shouting. She called him a Cossack and socked him. Then he arrested her. Then I socked him."
A pang of pity for the stricken officer passed through me. Orlo, as I have said, was well nourished, and Vanessa was one of those large girls who packed a hefty punch. A cop socked by both of them would have entertained no doubt as to his having been in a fight. But this was not what was occupying my thoughts. At the words, "She was heading the procession with me," I had started visibly. Seemed to me that, coupled with "that woman I love" stuff, they could mean only one thing. "Good Lord," I said, "is Vanessa Cook the woman you love?"
"She is."
"Nice girl," I said, for there was never any harm in giving the old salve. "And of course, radiant beauty-wise in the top 10. A moment later I was regretting that I had pitched it so strongly, for the effect on Orlo was most unpleasant. His eyes bulged, at the same time flashing as if he were on the verge of making a fiery far-to-the-left speech.
"You know her?"
he demanded, his voice low and guttural, like that of a bulldog which has attempted to swallow a chomp-chop and only got it down halfway. I saw that I would do well to watch my step, for it was evident that what I had heard Jeeves call the green-eyed monster that doth mock the meat it feeds on was beginning to feel the rush of life beneath its keel. "You never know what may happen after the GEM takes over." "Slightly," I said. "Oh, just slightly. We just met for a moment at some cocktail party or another."
"That was all?"
"That was all."
"You were not, how shall I put it, in any sense intimate?"
"No, no, simply on good morning, lovely morning, is it not terms, if I happened to run into her in the street."
"Nothing more."
Nothing more. I'd said the right thing. He went off the boil, and when next he spoke, it was without bulldog and chomp-chop effects.
You call her a nice girl. That puts in a nutshell my own opinion of her.
And she, I imagine, thinks highly of you.
Correct.
You're engaged, possibly.
Yes.
Many happy returns.
But we can't get married because of her father.
He objects?
Strongly.
But surely you don't have to have her father's consent in these enlightened days. A look of pain came into his face, and he writhed like an electric fan. It was plain that my words had touched a sore S.
You do if he's the trustee for your money, and you don't make enough at your job to marry on. My Uncle Joe left me enough to get married to 20 girls. He was Vanessa's father's partner in one of those big provision businesses. But I can't touch it because he made old Cook my trustee, and Cook refuses to part.
Why?
He disapproves of my political views. He says he has no intention of encouraging any damned communists.
I think at this juncture I may have looked askance at him a bit. I hadn't realized that that was what he was, and it rather shocked me, because I'm not any too keen on communists. However, he was my guest, so to speak, so I merely said that it must have been unpleasant. And he said yes, very unpleasant, adding that only Cook's grey hairs had saved him from getting plugged in the eye, which shows that it's not such a bad thing to let your hair go grey.
And in addition to disliking my political views, he considers that I have led Vanessa astray. He has heard about her going on these protest marches, and he considers me responsible. But for me, he says, she would have never done such a thing, and that if she ever made herself conspicuous and got her name in the papers, she would come straight home and stay there. He has a big house in the country with a stable of racehorses, as he can well afford to after his years of grinding the faces of the widow and the orphans.
I could have corrected him here, pointing out that you don't grind people's faces by selling them pressed beef and potato chips at a lower price than they would be charged elsewhere. But, as I say, he was my guest. So I refrained. I was conscious of a passing thought that Vanessa Cook would not be remaining long in London now that she had developed this habit of sucking policemen. But I did not share this with Orlo Porter, not wishing to rub salt into the wound.
You can drop me anywhere around here. Thanks for the ride.
Don't mention it.
Where are you going?
Harley Street, to see a doctor. I've got spots on my chest. The effect of this disclosure was rather remarkable. A keen go-getter look came over his face, and I could see that Orlo Porter, the lover, had been put in storage for the time being, his place taken by Orlo Porter, the zealous employee of the London and Home Counties Insurance Company.
Spots?
He asked. Pink, I said.
Pink spots?
He said.
That's serious. You'd better take out a policy with me.
I reminded him I already had done so. He shook his head.
Yes, yes, yes. But that was only for accidents. What you must have now is a life policy, and most fortunately.
He said this and drew papers from his pocket, like a conjurer taking rabbits from a hat.
I happen to have one on me. Sign here, Worcester.
He said, this time producing a fountain pen. And such was his magnetism that I signed then and there. He registered his approval.
You've done a wise thing, Worcester. Whatever the doctor may tell you when you see him, however brief your span of life, it will be a comfort to you to know that your widow and the little ones are provided for. Drop me right here, Worcester.
I dropped him and drove on to Harley Street.
3.
In spite of being held up by the protest march, I was a bit early for my appointment, and was informed on arrival that the medicine man was tied up for the moment with another gentleman. I took a seat and was flitting idly with the pages of an illustrated London News of the previous December when the door of E. Jimson Murgatroyd's private lair opened, and there emerged an elderly character with one of those square empire-building faces, much tanned, as if he was accustomed to sitting out in the sun without his parasol. Seeing me, he drank me in for a while and then said, "Hello," and conceive my emotion when I recognized him as Major Plank, the explorer and rugby football aficionado whom I had last seen at his house in Gloucestershire when he was accusing me of trying to get £5 out of him under false pretenses. A groundless charge, I need scarcely say, self being as pure as the driven snow, if not pure. But things had got a bit difficult, and the betting was that they would become difficult now. I sat waiting for him to denounce me, and was wondering what the harvest would be, when he spoke, to my astonishment, in the most bonhomous way, as if we were old buddies.
"We've met before. I never forget your face. Isn't your name Alan, or Allenby, or Alexander, or something?"
"Worcester," I said, relieved to the core. I'd been anticipating a painful scene. He clicked his tongue.
"I could have sworn it was something beginning with Al. It's this malaria of mine. Picked it up in Equatorial Africa. It affects my memory. So you've changed your name, have you? Secret enemies after you?"
"No, no secret enemies."
"That's generally why one changes one's name. I had to change mine that time. I shot the chief with the Mugombis. In defense, of course. But it made no difference to his widows and surviving relatives who were looking for me. If they had caught me, they would have roasted me alive over a slow fire, which is a thing one always wants to avoid. But I baffled them. Plank was the man they were trying to contact, and it never occurred to them that somebody called George Bernard Shaw could be the chap they were after. They are not very bright in those parts. Well, Worcester, how have you been since last we met? Pretty bobbish?"
"Oh, fine, except that I've got spots on my chest."
"Spots? That's bad. How many?"
I said I had not actually taken a census, but there were quite a few. He shook his head gravely.
"Might be the bubonic plague, or possibly sprue, or histosomiosis. One of those native bears got spots on his chest, and we buried him before sundown. Had to. Delicate fellows, those native bearers. Though you wouldn't think it to look at them. Catch everything that's going around. Sprue, bubonic plague, histomiosis, jungle fever, cold in the head, the lot. Well, Worcester, it's been nice seeing you again. I would ask you to lunch, but I have a train to catch. I'm off to the country."
He left me, as you may imagine, in something of a twitter. Bertram Worcester, as is well known, is intrepid, and it takes a lot to scare the pants off him. But this talk of native bears who had to be buried before sundown had caused me not a little anxiety. Nor did the first sight of E. Jimson Murgatroyd do anything to put me at ease. Tipton had warned me that he was a gloomy old buster, and gloomy old buster was what he proved to be. He had sad, brooding eyes and long whiskers, and his resemblance to a frog which had been looking on the dark side since it was a slip of a tadpole sent my spirits right down into the basement. However, as so often happens when you get to know a fellow better, he turned out to be not nearly as pessimistic, a God help us, as he appeared to be at first sight. By the time he had weighed me and tied that rubber thing round my biceps and felt my pulse and tapped me all over like a whiskered woodpecker, he had quite brightened up, and words of good cheer were pouring out of him like ginger beer from a bottle.
"I don't think you have much to worry about,"
he said. "You don't," I said, considerably bucked up. "Then it isn't sprue or histosomiosis."
"Of course not. What gave you the idea that it might be?"
"Well, Major Plank said it might. The chap who was in here before me."
"You shouldn't listen to people, especially Plank. We were at school together. Barmy Plank, we used to call him. No, the spots are of no importance. They'll disappear in a few days."
"Well, that's a relief," I said, and he said he was glad I was pleased.
"But,"
he added, this chipped a bit off my joie de vivre. "But what?" He was looking like a minor prophet about to rebuke the sins of the people. It was the whiskers that did it, mostly, though the eyebrows helped. I forgot to mention that. He had bushy eyebrows, and I could see that this was where I got the bad news.
"Mr. Worcester, you're a typical young man about town."
"Oh, thank you," I responded, for it sounded like a compliment, and one always likes to say the civil thing.
"And like all young men of your type, you pay no attention to your health. You drink too much."
"Only at times of special revelry. Last night, for instance, I was helping a pal to celebrate the happy conclusion of love's young dream, and it may be I became a mite polluted, but that rarely happens. One Martini Worcester, some people call me. He paid no attention to my frank, manly statement, but carried on regardless.
You smoke too much. You stay up too late at night. You don't get enough exercise. At your age, you ought to be playing rugby for the old boys of your school.
I didn't go to a rugby school.
Where did you go?
Eton.
Oh.
He said, and he said it as if he didn't think much of Eton.
Well, there you are. You do all the things I said. You abuse your health 100 different ways. Total collapse could come at any moment.
Any moment? I quivered.
Any moment. Unless.
Unless? Now I felt he was talking.
Unless you give up this unwholesome London life. Go to the country. Breathe pure air. Go to bed early. Get plenty of exercise. And if you don't do this, I cannot answer for the consequences.
He had shaken me. When a doctor, even if Whisker, tells you he cannot answer for the consequences, well, that's strong stuff. But I was not dismayed, because I had spotted a way of following his advice without anguish. Bertram Worcester is like that. He thinks on his feet. Would it be all right, I asked, if I went to stay with my aunt in Worcestershire? He weighed the question, scratching his nose with his stethoscope. He'd been doing this at intervals during our get-together, being evidently one of the scratchers like Barbara Fritchie. The poet Nash would have taken to him.
I don't have any objection to your staying with your aunt, provided the conditions are right. Whereabouts in Worcestershire does she live?
Near a town called Market Snodsbury.
Is the air pure there?
Excursion trains are run for people to breathe it.
Your life would be quiet?
Practically unconscious.
No late hours?
None. Early dinner, restful spell with a good book, or a crossword puzzle, and then to bed.
Well then, by all means, do as you suggest.
Splendid. I'll ring her up right now. The aunt to whom I alluded was my good and deserving Aunt Dahlia, not to be confused with my Aunt Agatha, who eats broken bottles and is strongly suspected of turning into a werewolf at the time of the full moon. Aunt Dahlia is as good a sort as ever said tally-ho to a fox, which she frequently did in her younger days when out with a corn or pitchley. If she ever turned into a werewolf, it would be one of those jolly breezy werewolves whom it is a pleasure to know. It was very satisfactory that he had given me the green light without probing further, for an extended quiz might have revealed that Aunt Dahlia has a French cook who defies competition, and I need scarcely explain that the first thing a doctor does when you tell him you're going to a house where there's a French cook is to put you on a diet. Well, that's that then, I said, all buckling joviality. Many thanks for your sympathetic cooperation. Lovely weather we're having, are we not? Good morning, good morning, good morning. I slipped him a purse of gold and were off to phone Aunt Dahlia. I had given up the idea of driving to Brighton for lunch. I had stern work before me. Viz., catching an invitation from this aunt, sometimes a tricky task. In her darker moods, when some domestic upheaval is troubling her, she has been known to ask me if I have a home of my own, and if I have, why the hell don't I stay there? I got her, after the delays inseparable from telephoning a remote hamlet like Market Snodsbury, where the operators are recruited exclusively from the Worcestershire branch of the Jukes family. "Hello, aged relative," I began, as suavely as I could manage. "Hello to you, you young blot on Western civilization!" She responded in the ringing tones with which she had once rebuked hounds for taking time off to chase rabbits. "What's on your mind, if any? Talk quickly, because I'm packing." I didn't like the sound of this. "Packing? Are you going somewhere?" "Yes, to Somerset, to stay with friends of mine, the Briscoes." "No curses." "Why?" "I was hoping I might come to you for a short visit." "Well, sucks to you then, young Bertie. You can't, unless you'd like to rally round and keep Tom company." I hummed at this. I'm very fond of Uncle Tom, but the idea of being cooped up alone with him in his cabin didn't appeal to me. He collects old silver and is apt to hold you with a glittering eye and talk your head off about scones and sconces and foliations and gadroon borders, and my interest in these is what you might call tepid. "No," I said, Thanks for the kind invitation, but I think I'll take a cottage somewhere."
Her next words showed that she had failed to grasp the gist of this.
"What's all this?" she queried. "I don't get it. Why have you got to go anywhere? Are you on the run from the police, Batty?"
"Doctor's orders."
"What are you fiddling about? You've always been fit as 10 fiddles.
"Until this morning, when spots appeared on my chest."
"Spots?"
"Pink."
"Probably leprosy."
"The doctor thinks not. His view is that they are caused by my being a typical young man about town who doesn't go to bed early enough. He says I must leg it to the country and breathe pure air, so I shall need a cottage."
"With honeysuckle climbing over the door and old Mr. Moon peeping in through the window."
"Yes, that sort of thing. Any idea how one sets about getting a cottage of that description?"
"I'll find you one. Jimmy Briscoe has dozens. And Maiden Eggersford, where he lives, is not far from the popular seaside resort of Brynmouth-on-Sea, notorious for its invigorating air. Corpses at Brynmouth-on-Sea leap from their biers and dance around the maypole."
"Sounds good."
"I'll drop you a line when I've got the cottage. You'll like Maiden Eggersford. Jimmy has a racing stable, and there's a big meeting coming on soon at Brynmouth. So you'll not only have pure air, but entertainment as well. One of Jimmy's horses is running, and most of the wise money is on it. Though there is a school of thought that maintains that danger is to be expected from a horse belonging to a Mr. Cook. And now, for heaven's sake, get off the wire, I'm busy."
"So far," I said to myself as I put back the receiver, "so gee. I would have preferred, of course, to be going to the aged relative's home, where Anatole, her superb chef, dished up his mouth-waterers, but we Worcesters can rough it. And life in a country cottage with the aged R just around the corner would be a very different thing from a country C without her to come through with conversation calculated to instruct, elevate, and amuse. All that remained now was to break the news to Jeeves, and I rather shrank from the prospect. You see, we had practically settled on a visit to New York, and I knew he was looking forward to it. I don't know what he does in New York, but whatever it is, it's something he gets a big kick out of. And disappointment, I feared, would be inevitable. "Jeeves," I said, when I had returned to the Worcester GHQ, "I'm afraid I have bad news."
"Indeed, sir. I'm sorry to hear that."
One of his eyebrows had risen about 1/8 of an inch, and I knew he was deeply stirred, because I had rarely seen him raise an eyebrow more than 1/16 of an inch. He had, of course, leaped to the conclusion that I was about to tell him that the medicine man had given me 3 months to live, or possibly 2.
"Dr. Murgatroyd's diagnosis was not encouraging, sir."
I hastened to relieve his apprehensions. "Yes, as a matter of fact, it was. Most encouraging. He said the spots qua spots. Is it qua?"
"Perfectly right, sir."
"His verdict was that the spots qua spots didn't amount to a row of beans and could be disregarded. They will pass me by like the idle wind, which I respect not."
"Extremely gratifying, sir."
"Extremely, as you say. But pause before you go out and dance in the streets, because there's more to come. It was to this that I was alluding when I said I had bad news. I've got to withdraw to the country and lead a quiet life. He says if I don't, he cannot answer for the consequences. So I'm afraid New York is off." Must have been a severe blow, but he bore it with the easy nonchalance of a Red Indian at the stake. Not a cry escaped him. "Merely and indeed, sir." And I tried to point out the bright side. "It's a disappointment for you, but it's probably an excellent thing. Everyone in New York is getting mugged these days, or shot by youths. And being mugged and shot by youths doesn't do a fellow any good. We shall avoid all that sort of thing at Maiden Eggerswit."
"Sir."
"Down in Somerset, Aunt Dahlia is visiting friends there, and is going to get me a cottage. It's near Brynmouth-on-Sea. Have you ever been to Brynmouth?"
"Frequently, sir, in my boyhood, and I know Maiden Eggersford well. An aunt of mine lives there."
"And an aunt of mine is going there. What a coincidence." I spoke blithely, for this obviously made everything artsy-tartsy. He had probably been looking on beetling off to the country as going into the wilderness, and the ecstasy of finding that the first thing he would set eyes on would be a loved aunt must have been terrific. So that was that. Having got the bad news broken, I felt at liberty to turn the conversation to other topics, and I thought he would be interested in hearing about my encounter with Plank. I got a shock at the doctor's, Jeeves.
"Indeed, sir.
Remember Major Plank?
The name seems vaguely familiar, sir, but only vaguely.
Throw the mind back. The explorer bloke, who accused me of trying to chisel him out of 5 quid, and was going to call the police. And you came along and said you were Inspector Witherspoon of Scotland Yard, and that I was a notorious crook whom you have been after for ages. And I was known as Alpine Joe, because I always wore an alpine hat. And then you took me away.
Ah, yes, sir. I remember now.
I ran into him this morning. He remembered my face, but nothing more, except that he had said he knew my face began with Al.
A most unnerving experience, sir.
Yes, it rattled me more than somewhat. It's a great relief to think that I shall never see him again.
I can readily understand your feelings, sir.
In due course, Aunt Dahlia rang up to say she had got a cottage for me, and to let her know what day I would be arriving. And so began what I suppose my biographers will refer to as the Maiden Eggersford Horror, or possibly the curious case of the cat which kept popping up when least expected.
4.
I left for Maiden Eggersford a couple of days later in the old two-seater. Jeeves had gone on ahead with the luggage, and would be there to greet me on my arrival, no doubt all braced and refreshed from communing with his aunt. It was in a jocund mood that I set forth. There were rather more astigmatic loonies sharing the road with me than I would have wished, but that did nothing to diminish my euphoria, as I've heard it called. The weather couldn't have been better, blue skies and sunshine all over the place, and to put the frosting on the cake, E. Jimson Murgatroyd had been 100% right about the spots. They had completely disappeared, leaving not a trace behind, and the skin on my chest was back to its normal alabaster. I reached the journey's end at about the hour of the evening cocktail, and got my first glimpse of the rural haven, which was to be the Worcester home, for I didn't know how long. Well, I had had a sort of idea that there would be what they call subtle but well-marked differences between Maiden Eggersford and such resorts as Paris and Monte Carlo. And a glance told me I had not erred. It was one of those villages where there isn't much to do except walk down the main street and look at the Jubilee watering trough, and then walk up the main street and look at the Jubilee watering trough from the other side. E. Jimson Murgatroyd would have been all for that. Oh boy, I could hear him saying, this is the stuff to give the typical young man about town. The air, as far as I could tell from the first few puffs, seemed about as pure as could be expected, and I looked forward to a healthful and invigorating stay. The only thing wrong with the place was that it appeared to be haunted, for as I alighted from the car, I distinctly saw the phantasm or wraith of Major Plank, and was coming out of the local inn, the Goose and Grasshopper, and as I gazed at it with bulging eyes, it vanished round the corner, leaving me, I need scarcely say, in something of a twitter. I am not, as I mentioned earlier, a fussy man, but nobody likes to have spectres horsing around, and for a while my jocund mood became a bit blue about the edges. I speedily pulled myself back together. "'Twas but a momentary illusion," I said to myself. I reasoned the thing out. If Plank had come to a sticky end since I had last seen him, and had started on a haunting career, I said to myself, why would he be haunting Maiden Eggersford when the whole of equatorial Africa was open to him? He would be much happier scaring the daylights out of natives whom he had cause to dislike, the widows and surviving relatives of the late chief of the Mogombes, for example. Fortified by these reflections, I went into the cottage. A glance told me it was all right. I think it must have been built for an artist or somebody like that, for it had all the modern cons, including electric light and telephone, being in fact more a desirable bijou residence than a cottage. Jeeves was there, and he brought me a much-needed refresher. In deference to E. Jimson Murgatroyd, a dry ginger ale. Sipping it, I decided to confide in him, for in spite of the clarity with which I had reasoned with myself, I was still not altogether convinced that what I had seen had not been a phantom. True, it looked solid enough, but I believe the best ghosts often do. "The most extraordinary thing, Jeeves," I said. "I could have sworn I saw Major Plank coming out of the pub just now."
"No doubt you did, sir. Major Plank would be quite likely to come to the village. He is the guest of Mr. Cook of Eggersford Court."
"You could have knocked me down with a cheese straw." "You mean he's here?"
"Yes, sir."
I was astounded. When he told me he was off to the country, I had naturally assumed he meant he was returning to his home in Gloucestershire. Not, of course, that there's any reason why someone who lives in Gloucestershire shouldn't visit Somerset.
Aunt Dahlia lives in Worcestershire, and she was visiting Somerset. You have to look at these things from every angle. Nonetheless, I was perturbed. I'm not sure I like this Jeeves.
No, sir.
He may remember what our last meeting was all about.
It should not be difficult to avoid him, sir.
Something in that. Still, what you say has given me a shock. Plank is the last person I want in my neighbourhood. I think, as my nervous system has rather taken the knock, we might discard the ginger ale and substitute it for a dry martini.
Very good, sir.
Murgatroyd will never know.
Precisely, sir.
And so, having breathed considerable quantities of pure air, and taken a couple of refreshing looks at the Jubilee watering trough, I went to bed early, as recommended by E. Jimson Murgatroyd. The result of this following of doctor's orders was sensational. Say what you might about his whiskers and his habit of looking as if he had been attending the funeral of a dear friend, E. Jimson knew his job. After about 10 hours of restful sleep, I sprang from between the sheets, leapt to the bathroom, dressed with a song on my lips, and headed for the breakfast table like a 2-year-old. I had cleaned up the eggs and bee, and got the toast and marmalade down the hatch to the last crumb, with all the enthusiasm of a tiger of the jungle tucking into its rations of coolie, and was smoking a soothing cigarette when the telephone rang, and Aunt Dahlia's voice came booming over the wire. "Hello, old ancestor," I said, and it was a treat to hear me, so full of ginger and loving-kindness was my diction. "A very hearty good morning to you, aged relative."
"You've got here, have you?"
"Yes, in person."
"So you're still alive? The spots didn't turn out to be fatal."
"They've entirely disappeared," I assured her. "Gone with the wind."
"That's good. I wouldn't have liked introducing a piebald nephew to the Briscoes. They want you to come to lunch today."
"Oh, how vastly civil of them."
"Have you got a clean collar?"
"Several, with immaculate shirts attached."
"Don't wear that Drones Club tie."
"Certainly not," I agreed. "If the Drone Club's tie has a fault, it's a little on the loud side and should not be sprung suddenly on nervous people and invalids. And I had no means of knowing if Mrs. Briscoe was one of these. What time is the binge?"
1:30.
"Expect me with my hair in a braid." The invitation showed a neighbourly spirit, which I applauded, and I said as much to Jeeves. "They sound like good eggs, these Briscoes."
"I believe they give uniform satisfaction, sir."
"Aunt Dahlia didn't say where they lived."
"At Eggersford Hall, sir."
"How does one get there?"
"One proceeds up the main street of the village to the high road, where one turns to the left. You cannot miss the house. It is large and stands in extensive grounds. It is a walk of about 1.5 miles, if you are intending to walk, sir."
"I think I'd better. Murgatroyd would advise it." "You, in my absence, will go and hobnob with your aunt. Have you seen her yet?"
"No, sir. I learned from the lady behind the bar at the Goose and Grasshopper, where I looked in on the night of my arrival, that she has gone to Liverpool for her annual holiday."
"Liverpool? Egad! Sometimes one feels that aunts live for pleasure alone." I made an early start. If these Briscoes were courting my society, I wanted to give them as much of it as possible. Reaching the high road where Jeeves had told me to turn to the left, I thought I'd better make sure. He had spoken confidently, but it's always well to get a second opinion. And by Jove, I found he had goofed. I accosted a passing centenarian. Everybody in Maiden Eggersford seemed to be about 150, no doubt owing to the pure air, and asked which way I turned for Eggersford Court. And he said to the right. It just showed how even Jeeves can be mistaken sometimes. On one point, however, he had been correct. A large house, he had said, standing in extensive grounds. I'd been walking what must have been 1.5 miles when I came in sight of just such a residence, standing in grounds such as he had described. There were gates opening on a long drive, and I started to walk up this when it occurred to me that I could save time by cutting across country, because the house I could see through the trees was a good deal to the nor-nor-east. They make these drives winding so as to impress visitors. Bless my soul, the visitor says, this drive must be 3/4 of a mile long. Shows how rich the chap is. Whether I was singing or not, I can't remember. More probably whistling. But be that as it may, I made good progress. I had just come abreast of what looked like the stables, when there appeared from nowhere a cat. It was a cat of rather individual appearance, being black in its general colour scheme, but with splashes of white about its ribs, and also on the tip of its nose. I chirruped,
and twiddle my fingers, as is my custom on these occasions, and it advanced with its tail up and rubbed its nose against my leg in a manner that indicated clearly that in Bertram Wooster it was convinced it had found a kindred soul in one of the boys. Nor had its intuition led it astray. One of the first poems I'd ever learned. I don't know who wrote it. Probably Shakespeare. It ran, "I loved little pussy, her coat is so warm, and if I don't hurt her, she'll do me no harm." And that is how I've been all my life. Ask any cat with whom I've had dealings, what sort of a chap I am, cat-wise, and it will tell you I am a thoroughly good egg, in whom complete confidence can safely be placed. Cats who know me well, like Aunt Dolly as Augustus, will probably allude to my skill at scratching them behind the ear. I scratched this one behind the ear, and it received the attention with obvious gratification, purring like the rumble of distant thunder. Cordial relations having now been established, I was proceeding to what you might call phase two, viz. Picking it up in my arms in order to tickle its stomach, when the welkin was split by a stentorian hi. There are many ways of saying hi. In America, it's a pleasant form of greeting, often employed as a substitute for good morning. Two friends meet. One of them says, "Hi, Bill," and the other replies, "Hi, George." Then Bill says, "Is it hot enough for you?" And George says, "Is that what he minds is not the heat but the humidity," and they go on their way. But this hi was something very different. I believe the sort of untamed savages Major Plank mixes with do not go into battle shouting hi, but if they did, the sound would be just like the uncouth roar which had nearly shattered my eardrums. Turning, I perceived a red-faced little half-portion brandishing a hunting crop I didn't like the look of. I've never been much fond of hunting crops since at an early age I was chased for a mile across difficult country by an uncle armed with one. He had found me smoking one of his cigars. In frosty weather I can still feel the old wounds. But now I wasn't really perturbed. This I took was the Colonel Briscoe, who had asked me to lunch, and though at the moment he had the air of one who would be glad to dissect me with a blunt knife, better conditions would be bound to prevail as soon as I mentioned my name. I mean, you don't ask a fellow to lunch and start assaulting and battering him as soon as he clocks in. I mentioned it, accordingly, rather surprised by his size, for I had thought they made colonels somewhat larger. Still, I suppose they come in all sizes, like potatoes, or, for that matter, girls. Vanessa Cook, for instance, was definitely on the substantial side, whereas others, who had turned me down from time to time, were practically midgets.
"Wooster, Bertram," I said, tapping my chest. I had anticipated an instant cooling of the baser passions, possibly a joyful cry and a, "How are you, my dear fellow? How are you?" accompanied by a sunny smile of welcome. But nothing of the sort occurred. He continued to effervesce, his face now rather pretty purple.
"What are you doing with that cat?"
he demanded hoarsely. I preserved a dignified calm. I didn't like his tone. But then one often doesn't like people's tones. "Merely passing the time of day," I replied, with a suavity that became me well.
"You are making away with it."
"Making a what?"
"Stealing it."
I drew myself up to full height, and I shouldn't be surprised if my eyes didn't flash. I've been accused of a good many things in my time, notably by my Aunt Agatha, but never of stealing cats. And the charge gave deep offence to the Worcester pride. Heated words were on the tip of my tongue, but I kept them in status quo, as the expression is. After all, the man was my host. With an effort to soothe, I said, "You wrong me, dear Colonel. I wouldn't dream of such a thing."
"Yes, you would. Yes, you would. Yes, you would. And don't call me Colonel."
It was hardly an encouraging start, but I tried it again. "Nice day."
"Damn the day."
"Crops coming in nicely?"
"Curse the crops."
"How's my aunt?"
"How the devil should I know how your aunt is?"
I thought this odd. When you've got an aunt staying with you, you ought to be able to supply inquirers with a bulletin, if only a sketchy one, of a state of health. I began to wonder if this little shrimp I was chatting with wasn't a bit fuzzy in the upper story. Certainly, as far as the conversation had gone at present, he would have aroused the professional interest of any qualified brain specialist. But I didn't give up. The Worcesters don't. I tried another tact altogether. "It was awfully kind of you to ask me to lunch," I said. I don't say he actually frothed at the mouth. There was no question, however, that my words had displeased him.
"Ask you to lunch? Ask you to lunch? I wouldn't ask you to lunch if..."
I think he was about to add with a 10-foot pole, but at this moment, from off stage, there came the sound of a robust tenor voice, singing what sounded like the song hit from some equatorial African musical comedy. And the next moment, Major Plank appeared, and the scales fell from my eyes. Plank being on the premises meant that this was not the Briscoe residence by a damn sight. By losing faith in Jeeves and turning to the right on reaching the high road, instead of to the left as he had told me, I'd come to the wrong house. For an instant I felt like blaming the centenarian, but we Worcesters are fair-minded, and I remembered I had asked him the way to Eggersford Court, which this joint presumably was. And if you say court when you mean hall, there's bound to be confusion. Good Lord, I said, suffused with embarrassment. Aren't you Colonel Briscoe? He didn't deign to answer that one, and Plank started talking.
Why, hello, Worcester,
he said.
Who would have ever thought of seeing me here? I didn't know you knew Cook.
Do you know him?
Said the purple chap, evidently stunned by the idea that I could have a respectable acquaintance.
Of course I know him. Met him at my place in Gloucestershire. Though under what circumstances I've forgotten. He'll come back. At the moment all I know is he has changed his name. It used to be something beginning with Al, and now it's Worcester. I suppose the original name was something ghastly, which he could not stand any longer. I knew a man at the United Explorers who changed his name from Buggins to Westmacott Trevelyan. I thought it very sensible of him, but it didn't do him much good, poor chap, because he'd scarcely got used to signing his IOUs Gilbert Westmacott Trevelyan when he was torn asunder by a lion. Still, that's the way it goes. How did you come out with the doctor, Worcester? Was it bubonic plague?
I said, no, it wasn't bubonic plague. He said he was glad to hear it, because bubonic plague was no joke, ask anyone.
Are you staying in these parts?
No, I have a cottage in the village.
Pity, you could have come here. Been company for Vanessa. Will you join us for lunch?
Said Plank, who seemed to think that a guest is entitled to issue invitations to his host's house, which any good etiquette book would have told him is not the case. I'm sorry, I said, I'm lunching at Eggersford Hall with the Briscoes. This caused Cook, who had been silent for some time, probably having trouble with his vocal cords, to snort visibly.
Oh, I knew it. I was right. I knew you were Briscoe's hireling.
What are you talking about, Cook?
Asked Plank, not abreast.
Never mind what I'm talking about. I know what I'm talking about. This man is in the pay of Briscoe, and he came here to steal my cat.
Why would he steal your cat?
You know why he would steal my cat. You know as well as I do that Briscoe stops at nothing. Look at this man. Look at his face. Guilt written all over it. I caught him with a cat in his arms. Hold him there, Plank, while I go and telephone the police.
And so saying, he legged it. I confess to being a little uneasy when I heard him tell Plank to hold me, because I'd had experience of Plank's methods of holding people. I believe I mentioned earlier that at our previous meeting he had proposed to detain me with the assistance of his Zulu knob-carry, and he had in his grasp now a stout stick, which if it wasn't a Zulu knob-carry was unquestionably the next best thing. Fortunately, he was in a friendly mood.
You mustn't mind Cook, Worcester. He's upset. He's been having a spot of domestic trouble. That's why he asked me to come and stay. He thought I might have advice to offer. He allowed his daughter Vanessa to go to London to study art at the Slade, if that's the name of the place. And she got in with the wrong crowd, got pinched by the police and so forth. Upon which Cook did the heavy father thing and jerked her home, and told her that she had to stay there till she learned a bit of good sense. She doesn't like it, poor thing. But I tell her, she's lucky not to be in Equatorial Africa, because there if a daughter blots her copybook, her father chops her head off, buries her in the back garden. Well, I hate to see you go, Worcester, but I think you'd better be off. I don't say Cook will be back with a shotgun, but you never know. I'd leave if I were you.
His advice struck me as good, so I took it.